You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, as the US's Russia probe continues to unfold, we'll ask why Donald Trump's lawyers have advised him not to talk to special counsel Robert Mueller. My guests, Daniela Pellet and Jacob Parakilas, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the continuing war of words between Israel and Poland, as Israel's education minister says he's honoured that a visit to Poland has been cancelled. Also ahead,
it was a great expansion of democratic participation, tripling the size of the electorate and empowering voices and perspectives which for centuries had been excluded.
As the UK marks 100 years since women gained the right to vote, we'll reflect on the suffragette struggle in Britain and further afield and ask what still needs to be done. We'll also consider if we're better off with a publicly or privately funded space race. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Jacob Parakilas, Deputy Head for the US and the Americas Programme at Chatham House. Welcome both of you to the programme. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible ties between Donald Trump's associates and Russian officials during the 2016 presidential race is honing in on an interview between Mueller and Trump himself. But now Trump's lawyers have advised him against talking to Mueller. Their main concern, apparently, is that if interviewed, Trump could end up being prosecuted for lying or contradicting himself. Jacob, is this a legitimate concern?
It is in some respects. It should be noted that Trump has a history of testifying in depositions before. Notably, in, I think, 2007, he sued Timothy O'Brien, who's now at Bloomberg, who'd written a book about him, which, amongst other things, claimed that his net worth was much lower than it actually was, or that he lower than his claims. And in that deposition, Trump freely admitted to have lied under other circumstances. It was some 30 lies that he basically said, yeah, no, I didn't tell the truth about that. So he's perfectly capable, when under oath, of actually sort of backing away from statements that he knows to be untrue. The question is, will Mueller's investigators be able to catch him out? Will they be trying to catch him out? What's the purpose of the investigation? Are they trying to establish his intent in firing James Comey, the head of the FBI? Are they trying to determine whether that constituted obstruction of justice? Because that's the question of obstruction of justice that they're clearly honing in on in this section of the investigation. And there are several other sections of the investigation, but let's leave those to the side for the moment. He's really trying to establish his state of mind at the time that he made those critical decisions. And the interview, I think, will be heavily focused on that. And it's unclear, and I think it'll be unclear to Trump, what other evidence they have and what they can kind of make his statements stack up against. Is it testimony from aides? Is it documents? Is it emails? A lot of that's unclear because, of course, Mueller's investigation is the only place in Washington these days that doesn't leak.
So, Daniela, obviously, Mr. Mueller could, if he wanted to, subpoena Trump, even if he refused to speak to him, and get him to testify under oath. So what is the broader strategy of Trump's lawyers here? What gamble are they making?
Well, obviously, if Trump declines to speak, then there's the narrative that you can easily play off, saying, well, if somebody doesn't have anything to hide, then why would they refuse such an interview? To be fair to Trump, and we can be fair to Trump, can't we? I think it's quite wise advice, and not just to him, but quite wise legal advice, not to give an interview such as this, because you are laying yourself open to all kinds of, you know, any kind of vulnerability, really. And it's not just about not telling the truth; it's what a clever interviewer can get out of you. But yeah, the perception is, if you don't talk, it means you've got something to hide. I'm not sure by this point it's going to be seen as being particularly damaging. But to really to really have an impact, the charges need to be, you know, not just at Trump's front door of obstruction of justice. It has to be right inside. It has to catch him in his bathrobe. You know, it's got to be really, it's got to get to the main address, because there are so many, at least five, I think, four or five other strands of investigation. This one really has to focus in very strongly on him and reach a definitive answer.
Jacob, with the vision of Donald Trump in his bathrobe foremost in my mind, I want to ask you about the White House's general attitude towards this investigation, its stance thus far, because I think it's basically behaved according to the logic of we have nothing to hide. Is that correct?
I'm not sure that is correct. I mean, the lawyers have been disputing with each other, and they've taken different approaches. Ty Cobb, who is a professional criminal defense lawyer, has basically encouraged, I think largely kept the president on track with, we're cooperating with a special counsel, we've turned over documents, we have done everything they've asked of us. Jay Sekulow, who's not a criminal defense lawyer, he was basically a legal advisor to conservative organizations for a long time, has taken a much more combative approach. He's encouraged the president's more sort of fight instincts, and that has created a little bit of dissonance, which you've seen play out in Trump's varying public statements. As with almost any issue, you can go back and sort of cherry pick a record of Trump saying that he'll cooperate, or you can go back and pick a record of Trump saying that, you know, well, we'll see whether I fire him. There's a red line that he can't cross, and so on and so forth. At the moment, it seems as though Trump has taken the approach that he has nothing to hide. He's happy to talk to Mueller. He said so specifically. He would be very happy to testify under oath. And you could just hear sort of his lawyers cringing from 4,000 miles away when he just basically threw that out to a bunch of journalists. So where this actually lands, I think what's probably going to happen is the negotiations are being handled through the legal team. I think what they are trying to do is to get a situation where Mueller's team submits questions in writing, or perhaps does an interview that's not under oath, that is conducted with them in the room. The worst case scenario is that Trump agrees either to an unsupervised interview or is subpoenaed, at which point he simply has to sit there in the witness chair, and his lawyers have limited capacity to intervene, and Mueller and his team can basically just run down the list of questions that they have.
Daniela, zooming out a little bit from the intricacies of the investigation, it's certainly true that the general image of the institutions of US politics and society and the way they interact that has been painted by the investigation is pretty confused and quite troubling. The FBI in particular has really been put through the ringer over the last couple of years. They were initially attacked from the left for releasing or for reinstating an investigation into Clinton's emails shortly before the election. Now the Republicans are accusing the FBI of potentially having been biased against them during the election. How far can Trump and the Republicans' relationship with bodies like the FBI, pillars of US society, be compromised before American people just say enough is enough and something has to happen to one of them?
Well, that's a good question, which is very, very hard to answer. I mean, my feeling a year ago was that, well, the institutions of American democracy are robust enough to deal with this coming I may have said to myself apocalypse, but perhaps crisis is a better word to use. I think also, despite these accusations being thrown here and there, that has more or less stood up. Though we can see that the different levers and the different balances have been fairly robust. I think one problem with this investigation is that it becomes so intricate and it becomes so complex, and it becomes so much about a point of law, not whether Trump did this or did that wrong, that the narrative again becomes very hard to follow for the general public, and it becomes more of a political inside baseball game without a clear winner or loser, and without a clear conviction. I mean, wouldn't that be wonderful? But so far, it's the story gets ever more confused.
Jacob, just finally, looking back into history, are there any parallels or lessons that we can find when it comes to presidents being under the microscope of investigations of various sorts?
The obvious recent historical parallel is Bill Clinton and his deposition as part of the Ken Starr investigation, that being the moment at which he famously said he did not have sexual relations with that woman. He was then impeached for perjury and obstruction of justice, but cleared by the Senate. So that's the obvious one. That's the one that the president's lawyers have in their mind every single day. Obviously, the political context is different. Clinton was up against a Republican House and a Republican Senate. Trump has both houses in the same party. And thus far, the Republicans have largely been pretty willing to avoid direct oversight and avoid direct scrutiny of the president. They take a variety of approaches on the larger question of Russian collusion, although the problem there is that collusion, this word that everyone throws around, is not in and of itself a crime. So there's some questioning of the legal theories. Well, you know, we're investigating collusion. There may be crimes associated with it, but the central thrust of this investigation is not a statutorily defined crime. So there's a whole kind of political aspect of this, because of course impeachment, the mechanism by which the president can be brought to heel, the mechanism that convinced Nixon to leave office, he would have certainly been removed by impeachment had he not resigned in 1974. Is fundamentally political. It's the House and Senate are not judicial bodies, but they act as judicial bodies in the process of impeachment. So there's this very strange mixture of Iran-Contra, the Bill Clinton sort of Watergate Omni scandal-ish thing, whatever it was, the scandals around Nixon, going back to Andrew Johnson and his very narrowly averted removal in the Senate by one vote. So there are a lot of precedents, but nothing that is exactly like this. And of course, this is still early in the Trump administration. All those other scandals happened fairly late in presidential terms.
We're going to watch this space, and we're going to move on now from relatively recent US political history to slightly less recent European history. Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, has signed into law a bill that bans any suggestion that Poland was complicit in the Holocaust. The bill was passed by Parliament last week and sparked immediate opposition, not least from Israel. Yesterday, Israel's education minister, Naftali Bennett, said he was honoured that a scheduled visit to Poland was cancelled after he refused to back down from criticising the bill. Daniela, we've been speaking to you in our coverage of this on Monocle 24. One question that's just loomed really large in my brain is why now? Why is this happening now, so long after World War II and the horrible events that unfolded in Poland during it?
Well, this has been simmering in Poland for a while. To put it simply, it's a super populist move that's it's quite characteristic for the current Polish government. The term Polish death camps was actually very cynically coined by a German pro-Nazi sympathiser in the 1950s to try and shift that guilt. And I think now the term is used more very insensitively, but I don't think necessarily willfully to try and... no one is trying to deny the German connection to it. But certainly there's been enormous Polish sensitivity to this whole issue, and understandably, because Poland suffered a lot under the Nazi occupation. They're the largest number of so-called righteous amongst the nations, Gentiles who saved Jews, designated come from Poland. So I can see why this is a sensitive issue. The problem is when you legislate issues of national memory and historical judgment, that's the alarming and disturbing thing. And what's particularly odious about this whole affair is that everyone, and I include the Israeli government in this, is making political capital over genocide, basically. Naftali Bennett's visit seems a bit fishy. It wasn't official, wasn't officially organised with the foreign ministry or anything of that sort. He comes from he's the leader of the very far-right pro-settler Habayit Ta'ud party, and it suits him very well to paint himself as the defender of the holy dead of the Holocaust. But I think, again, it's a cynical ploy by him to court his public, just as the Polish government are using a cynical ploy to try and make the electorate feel better about themselves.
Jacob, the Polish President Duda has acknowledged that individual Poles did commit crimes against Jews during World War II. But he says that the Polish state bears no responsibility because it ceased to exist following the invasion by Nazi Germany and later the Soviet Union. Is that an instructive distinction to make?
It's a distinction without much subtlety. And this is the problem with these sort of nationalistic attempts to legislate historical memory. I think that's a very good turn of phrase. I think the problem there is that it's not a simple distinction between the individual and the state. I mean, obviously, the Polish state as constituted prior to 1939 didn't really exist, but there were still administrative structures. There were still, structures that were preserved or sort of slightly modified, and did, that did cooperate in various ways. And that was true in every country that came under occupation. It's true of every country that comes under occupation throughout history. It's easier militarily and strategically to co-opt institutions than to knock them down and completely rebuild them, as the U.S. found out to its detriment in Iraq in 2003. The problem with this kind of debate is that there are a lot of nuances and there are a lot of subtleties that, a blanket ban on specific language isn't necessarily the best tool to combat.
Daniela, the Polish government obviously want all of the responsibility for the crimes that were committed under Nazi-occupied Poland, in Nazi-occupied Poland, to be shifted on to Germans and Germany and Nazi Germany in particular. But there's a certain irony there in that Germany is frequently held up as an exemplar of how to deal with atrocities that a nation has committed in its past. It's widely regarded as having been quite good at that. What is it about Polish culture, and Poland certainly isn't alone in this regard, that is perhaps preventing it from acknowledging this as fully as it should or with dealing with it? Is it just always incredibly complex for countries to come to terms with paths like this?
Oh, it's very hard, of course, but you're right. I think Germany did a sterling job in it. And also in terms of memorialising its own more recent past, if you go to Berlin and you see the way that the Berlin Wall is memorialised and it's built, these memorials are built into the fabric of the city, for instance, is a very interesting way of dealing with your past and seeing how it relates to the present as well. Lots of countries like to present themselves as the first victims of National Socialism. I think of Austria for one of them. The Poles have got fairly good and convincing arguments for this because they did suffer, as I said, hugely. But also Polish sovereignty is fairly new. It's a country that's been invaded and occupied and chopped up innumerable times over the last few hundred years. And I think in a country that's whose identity is really fairly new and developing, I think there's the very huge sensitivities about this national self-image. I mean, not to put the point too crudely, but I think Israel also has that issue. Israel is another country that feels very, very sensitive about language, about depiction of current politics and past history. Mr. Bennett's own party has been one of those most active in legislating for a shrinking space of democracy in Israel as well. So I think there's something that connects the two things. I think a country that's more at ease with itself and its history doesn't feel the need to pass laws to make certain discourse legal or illegal. I think that's what's happening in Poland, I think.
Well, you are listening to Midori House here with me, Henry Rhys Sheridan, Jacob Parakilis and Daniela Peled. Coming up next, the UK celebrates 100 years of women's suffrage and the future of the space race.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Daniela Peled and Jacob Parakilas. 100 years ago today, the Representation of the People Act gave women, those over 30 and of property at least, the right to vote in the UK. Today, there are events commemorating the suffragette struggle all over the country. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, has given a speech marking the occasion in Manchester, the home of suffrage movement leader Emmeline Pankhurst. Daniela, it strikes me that the centenary of the UK suffrage, of the passing of UK suffrage, has fallen at a time of radically heightened cultural sensitivity around sexual harassment of women. Also at a time when a man who's admitted to harassing women is in the White House, Donald Trump. Should that context affect the way we commemorate suffrage?
Well, I think we have been commemorating it here in England, at least, as in a sort of rather cutesy way. I think we're looking back at these sweet suffragettes with their petticoats and their frills and furbelows, and it hasn't been. I haven't found it particularly inspiring. Perhaps it's because we're looking so far into the past, and that suffrage itself was significant, but the gains from the women's movement and equality did not follow immediately. If we look at plenty of other countries gave women the vote before, and also not only gave women the vote, but women did vote and they got elected to Parliament as well. We're still lagging quite far behind when it comes to the proportion of women who are actively involved in politics. So I think what's happening now, the ongoing struggle for equality, I think I find that much more inspiring than this sort of tendency to look back and in this rather dusty and somehow lavender smelling kind of way.
There have been an awful lot of period costumes, I've noticed, at least in photographs of the demonstrations. But Daniela, I just want to stay with you for a second. Theresa May in her speech said that she considered making it illegal to abuse political candidates online. She acknowledged that that kind of abuse disproportionately affects women and minority candidates. Do you think that the suffragettes of a century ago would have been surprised at the continuing barriers to women's participation in politics?
Well, I don't think we should make any of this illegal. I think once you start, again, legislating, it becomes a very slippery slope. And I'm not quite sure how then your entire police resources are dedicated to people sending evil tweets to public figures. I think the suffragettes would be amazed at how far we've come. And I don't think they were all so massively liberal as we see now from our perspective 100 years later. I don't think they would have stopped to think the idea that we should now make Parliament more child-friendly and more family-friendly, and that all the equal opportunities legislation, shared parental leave, and all of these things, that was not even on their radar. And I doubt they would have necessarily approved. They seemed quite straight-laced, really.
Jacob, we've mentioned that the UK wasn't the first, certainly wasn't the last country to give suffrage to women. New Zealand was the first in 1893. Saudi Arabia came through in 2011. If you look at the historical sweep, there are some weird kind of anomalies. Switzerland made it, passed federal suffrage in 1971. The last canton to pass local suffrage was in 1991, astonishingly. What lessons can we learn from looking at the progression of women's suffrage around the world, not only about women's liberation, but also about political liberation more generally?
Well, I think there's a point where about historical memory here. And it's interesting. It would be interesting to compare. And I haven't done this work myself, and I'm sure other people have. I think it's an interesting comparative thing to look at how when things start slipping out of living memory, how the radicalism gets sort of sanded down. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation right now because there's been, a lot of dispute over Martin Luther King's legacy in the United States. States, where just this weekend there was an ad for Ram trucks using a Martin Luther King speech, which would have come as a surprise to Dr. King, who was quite searing in his critique of capitalism and the Vietnam War. But he's now remembered as this kind of apolitical teddy bear pushing for something broadly that you know, Americans broadly see, that people in the world broadly see as an unambiguous good. Well, actually, if you go back and look at public opinion polls, and it's the same, I think it's the same for suffrage in almost any country, it wasn't something that everyone woke up one morning and said, actually, this is the right thing to do. It was controversial. It was difficult. It was, you know, it created a lot of social dissension. And I think we have to be wary of this tendency to kind of look backwards and just say, oh, this was a historical inevitability and everyone has come to agree with it and there's no more work to be done.
Yeah, I don't think in the vast span of history that the women being able to vote was the definitive moment where everything began to change. I can think of many in the last century, many other points which made a much more substantive difference to even in women's involvement in politics. And the level of female involvement in politics doesn't necessarily say it tells us everything we need to know about a country as well. I can think of one country where I work quite a lot, in Afghanistan. There's a quota for women participation in the parliament. And, well, it's important, but I wouldn't say that we've reached a state of equality there either.
Well, on that point, I think the election of Donald Trump, it's fair to say, has energized the women's movement in some parts of the world in a way that very few other events in recent memory have. How do you think that energy should be directed to maximum effect? I know that's a big question. You've got about 30 seconds to answer it.
As representative of all women.
Yes, please. I will ask Jacob afterwards.
Well, I think that the Me Too movement has made a huge difference. I think I'm bracing myself now, though, for the backlash, which is already incipient. But I think as a social movement, it has and will continue to have long-lasting repercussions which have gone from Hollywood to, you know, all areas of public and private life.
Like the historian said about the French Revolution, it's too early to say. I mean, I think there's a real danger of significant backlash. And U.S. politics in particular has been defined recently by sort of waves of backlash and counter-backlash. And, you know, I think Trump was one kind of backlash. Me Too is another kind of backlash. There is a further sort of reactionary backlash beyond that. And which one of them will be ultimately determinative, I think, is unsettled as of yet.
Well, finally on today's show, a NASA X-ray laboratory has detected for the first time a population of planets beyond our Milky Way galaxy. Not so long ago, it seemed every space-related write-up cited the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which was set up as a government program nearly 60 years ago. But nowadays, more and more spacey headlines contain the name of the entrepreneur Elon Musk and his private company SpaceX. Indeed, today Musk is planning on launching the world's most powerful rocket, essentially created by strapping three of his already very powerful rockets together. NASA's declining significance has been mourned, but isn't it better for private money to fuel this kind of highly explosive and risky R&D than public? Daniela?
I'm not so sure about that. I think it's if you look at the big players in this world, it's Musk, Richard Branson, who wants to send us into space for our holidays. I think Jeff Bezos as well. It's this kind of rich boys plaything. I wonder if they're all getting building bases in hollow volcanoes as well. I quite liked it, the idea that of the space race, and that was something that for the whole of humanity's future. And there was something to be said for actually just exploring space as this grand fate of us all. That's no longer very fashionable, really. And I can't see any way in which governments could continue to fund it in this way. But yeah, this doesn't capture my imagination in quite the same way.
Jacob?
We should note that Elon Musk isn't just planning to launch, and he's, as we speak, the countdown is happening, so we'll find out shortly what happens. But it's also that he's put his personal Tesla Roadster, he's going to fire it. If all goes well, it'll go into Mars orbit, playing David Bowie as it goes, which is not the kind of stunt that NASA did some funny things, but not on this scale. I mean, basically, I think, yeah, I agree with Danielle. I mean, I think, you know, I would love to see a president say, I'm doubling NASA's budget, and I want it to increase its ambition by a factor of 10. I don't think that's going to happen for a variety of political reasons. I would rather we had you know, I think space exploration is important, but I would rather it be for common purposes rather than kind of privatized and even individualized.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Jacob Parakilis and Daniela Pellet, thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Mara. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next in the 1900 Hours. It's our design show, Section D, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 Hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Goodbye.